Drugs when you need them most. You don't have to be first, you just need to be best. This is Porter & Company's Best Buys, which we publish on the fourth Saturday of the month. You can go here to see past Best Buys. If Oliver Cromwell had taken quinine, he'd likely have been alive at his own execution. As it was, in 1661, he was put on trial for treason, hanged, beheaded, and had his head stuck on a spike on the roof of Westminster Hall, 3 years after he died from malaria. Cromwell, a fanatic Protestant statesman, had overthrown and executed England's Catholic-leaning King Charles I in 1649 and established a strict Protestant republic, which he ruled with an iron fist, as Lord Protector, naturally, not as king. Cromwell enjoyed absolute power until 1658, when a mosquito corrupted him absolutely. Not that anyone knew it was a mosquito, carrying the deadly Plasmodium parasite. Malaria, Italian for bad air, had migrated to Europe from Africa via the slave trade in the late 16th century. And no one could agree on what caused fever and ague, with theories ranging from foul weather to spiders. What was certain was that it was fatal. The journal Nature estimates that 50 billion or 60 billion victims, about half of all the people in human history, have died from malaria's 1-2 punch of violent chills and 107-degree fever. And, until the 1630s, there was no cure, unless you counted remedies like cat's blood or groundwood chips. Then a monk called Antonio de la Calancha discovered Jesuit bark. De la Calancha ran a Catholic mission in the Andes and observed that the natives had their own treatment for fever, a tree with bark of cinnamon color that, when ground into powder, cures the ague. This was the bark of the cinchona tree, a natural source of fever suppressant quinine. Antonio and his fellow Jesuit monks tested the miraculous bark on patients in the mission, wrote up the results, and sent the powder, along with explanatory pamphlets, to pharmacists in Europe. Results were mixed. The Catholics thought Jesuit bark was a brilliant remedy. And the Protestants, an increasingly large minority in Europe's religious brawls, wanted nothing to do with it. Calling it the devil's dust, they wrote it off as a papist plot to poison them. They'd rather die of the fever, and many of them did. Oliver Cromwell was one of the casualties. Fanatic to the end, the Lord Protector refused quinine and died of severe malarial fever at age 59. But that was not quite the end of his story. After Cromwell's death, his shaky republic collapsed, and Charles II, King Charles' son, returned from exile in France, eager to avenge his father. Cromwell, his father's murderer, was, of course, dead and buried. Undeterred, young King Charles hauled the corpse out of the vault, made a public spectacle of Cromwell's posthumous treason trial, and impaled the Lord Protector's head on a rooftop spike, where it would remain for another 20 years, until it blew off in a storm. The legends around Jesuit bark swirled for far longer. A bite worse than the bark quinine gradually spread across Europe and made its way to America, but retained a lingering stigma, surrounded by a miasma of popishness and secrecy. Malaria, too, continued to spread, wherever there were crowds of people and bodies of standing water, and to strike slaves, popes, kings, presidents, and soldiers indiscriminately. Quinine was the only remedy that worked, but it continued to suffer from bad PR. Part of the problem was that, in an increasingly civilized society, no one wanted to grind up bad-tasting bark into powder. Enter Dr. Carl Warburg, who had no medical credentials that could be discovered, but was said to be a very fine guitar player. In between tarantellas, he developed a proprietary bottled quinine remedy with the powder pre-mixed into a liquid. Warburg's tincture, as he named it, was disgusting. It was also, frankly, unserious. Dr. Warburg flogged his nostrum throughout Europe and America from 1834 until 1875, and obstinately refused to reveal its ingredients. Chemists' analyses showed that it was mainly quinine concealed in a farrago of inert substances, for purposes of mystification. It gained some notoriety, and also a persistent reputation as a quack remedy. After spending all his money, and his ex-wife's, on producing the medicine, Warburg gave in and released the secret ingredient list, with quinine at the top. A few years later, he died bankrupt. Warburg's tincture left a generation of children better off, but with a bad taste in their mouths, which did nothing to fix quinine's PR problem. That was up to a small three-man chemist company in Indianapolis, in 1876, 1 year after Warburg's ingredient reveal. The chemists at the company knew that quinine needed image rehabilitation, so they decided to create a pre-mixed quinine tincture that would go right where Warburg went wrong. They openly listed and advertised their ingredients, invited scrutiny, and, perhaps most crucially, masked the bitter taste of quinine by mixing it into chocolate drops. Chocolate quinine proved to be the golden ticket. Within the next 3 years, company sales had skyrocketed tenfold, and quinine candy was on drugstore shelves across the nation and then the world. Over the next decades, Quinine shed any remaining stigma and reached a fever pitch of demand, such that it started several supply chain wars and ignited a new industry, synthetic quinine. One of those synthetic products is hydroxychloroquine, which President Donald Trump recommended as a kind of Warburg's tincture cure-all for COVID. Today, the three-man chemist shop that cooked up chocolate quinine is a household name. Antonio de la Calancha, the monk who found Jesuit bark, and Dr. Warburg, who packaged it as a tonic? Not so much. Which brings us to a hard truth. Quite often, history forgets the innovator. It remembers the mass marketer. That chemist shop that added mass appeal to Jesuit bark has had a long history of improving on other people's good ideas and getting them in front of a wider audience. Quinine was just the first of these products. The company has followed the same strategy repeatedly over its 200-year existence. It definitely qualifies as a Lindy business and is now an $800 billion biopharma behemoth. Today, we are adding it to the top of our best buys list because it's just delivered a new, crowd-pleasing twist on an already successful medicine. 1. Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY, that three-man chemical shop that started on Pearl Street in Indianapolis in 1876 has grown into Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY, the global leader in the booming market for GLP-1 diabetes and weight loss drugs. Why we recommended Eli Lilly? The GLP-1 weight loss drug market is highly competitive and is driving the narrative in the pharmaceutical industry at the moment. Eli Lilly displaced the former industry leader, Novo Nordisk, NVO, achieving 50% market share last year, which it has since significantly surpassed. Its leading injectable weight loss drug Mounjaro, tirzepatide, has experienced massive growth, with Q4 2025 revenue hitting $7.4 billion, representing a 110% year-over-year increase. Combined with Zepbound, this growth is driven by high demand and expanded manufacturing, having been a key driver for Eli Lilly's 2025 revenue. Lilly projects 2026 revenue of $80 billion to $83 billion, driven by massive demand for these obesity drugs, and its projections for 2027 suggest revenue could reach close to $100 billion, representing continued, significant growth driven by the launch of oral GLP-1 orforglipron. Already, the booming sales of Eli Lilly's GLP-1 drugs have made it one of the fastest-growing pharmaceutical companies in the world. Since the 2022 launch of Mounjaro, the company's revenue has increased 20% each year, and this trend is expected to continue through at least 2029. Why Eli Lilly is a best buy? So far, the main GLP-1 drugs on the market come in an injectable form, including Mounjaro and Zepbound, as well as Novo Nordisk's Ozempic and Wegovy. More recently, big pharma companies have been racing to create the first pill form of the drug, which opens up a massive new source of demand from consumers who don't want to stab themselves with a needle. And so far, Lilly has led with a more consumer-friendly product on this. On April 1, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, granted speedy approval to Foundayo, orforglipron, Lilly's once-daily weight loss pill. To cement this lead, Lilly has secured same-day delivery through Amazon Pharmacy and a $3 billion manufacturing expansion in China, ensuring the supply chain can actually meet the explosive global demand. The overall weight loss market is still largely untapped, with only about 4% of Americans currently using the drugs, while 40% of the population is obese. Eli Lilly will continue to be one of the biggest winners from this trend, and it's just getting started. Analysts estimate the overall market will grow from around $50 billion today to between $100 billion to $150 billion by 2030. Despite a 15% YTD dip in share price due to high valuation jitters and a projected $584 million Q1 research and development charge, Eli Lilly's underlying fundamentals have never been stronger. With $80 billion plus in revenue guidance for 2026 and Medicare expansion for Foundayo set to begin in July, the recent stock pullback looks less like a breakdown and more like a high conviction entry point for investors. As the company prepares for its April 30th earnings call, the focus shifts from if they can lead the obesity market to how much they will dominate it. Action to take: buy Eli Lilly, NYSE, LLY, up to $1,363.07 per share too. Waterbridge Infrastructure, NYSE, WBI, Waterbridge Infrastructure, NYSE, WBI, manages the water that is extracted from the ground as part of oil and gas production in the Permian Basin in West Texas. Why we recommended Waterbridge Infrastructure: produced water is a byproduct of oil and gas extraction, and there is money to be made managing it, purifying it, and reselling it. Lots of money. Waterbridge Infrastructure owns the largest network of produced water infrastructure in the U.S. 2,500 miles of pipelines and 197 produced water handling facilities, focused on the Permian Basin. The business processes 2.6 million barrels per day of produced water, generating $790 million in annual revenue. The process is straightforward. The company gathers produced water from third-party oil and gas producers directly at the well site, and then sends the water through its pipeline network to a processing facility. There, water is separated from production chemicals, mineral solids, and any residual oil or gas. WaterBridge's focus on safety has helped it aggressively take market share as its less prudent competitors get shut down. In fact, its 24-hour well monitoring program is so sophisticated that the Texas Railroad Commission uses WaterBridge data for its own regulatory oversight. Another major advantage WaterBridge has over its competitors is the sheer scale of the business. As the owner of the largest produced water pipeline network in America, WaterBridge has layers of redundancy throughout its infrastructure. This way, if injection pressures rise in certain areas, automatic shutoff valves can reroute water to lower pressure injection sites. The market has priced WaterBridge shares at a similar valuation as if it were a traditional oil and gas pipeline business, which typically trade around 8x to 12x earnings. The better analogy for WaterBridge is the municipal waste business. Looking at companies like Waste Connections, WCN, or Waste Management, WM. The reason for their success is simple. Obtaining a permit for a new municipal waste landfill is nearly impossible in America, as is the case for getting permits to manage produced water in West Texas. And with water disposal demand in West Texas rising at a rapid pace, while available permitted pore space declines, WaterBridge finds itself in an even more enviable competitive position than its solid waste peers. That's how the company generates stellar operating margins, well ahead of traditional pipeline businesses and even above those of the higher quality municipal waste companies, at 50% margins. Why WaterBridge infrastructure is a best buy? These stellar margins reflect WaterBridge's powerful competitive moat, yet Wall Street hasn't given the company full credit for its superior business model. At $28 per share, WaterBridge trades at a multiple of around 11x, right in line with oil and gas pipeline operators, and at a steep discount to its municipal waste peers, which trade at 15x to 16x. Given WaterBridge's deep competitive moat and stellar margins, we believe it should command a premium valuation multiple of something around 15x to 20x. Plus, there's also the growth component. Given the long-term trend of rising volumes of produced water in the Permian Basin, and WaterBridge's ability to take a greater portion of the market share than most competitors, we believe the business is well positioned for 15% to 20% annual growth rates. Thus, we see a conservative upside case for the business to deliver 40% earnings growth over the next 2 years to around $560 million. Assuming a valuation range of 15x to 20x, that would put its share price in a range of $55 to $75 by year-end 2027, or a return of roughly 100% to 170% in the next 2 years from its recent price of $28. Action to take: buy WaterBridge Infrastructure, NYSE, WBI, up to $30 per share. 3. LandBridge, NYSE, pound. LandBridge, NYSE, pound, is a leading land acquisition and management company in the Permian Basin. Why we recommended LandBridge? The company owns the surface rights to 315,000 acres of land in the heart of the Delaware Basin, making it the second largest landholder in the Permian Basin, just behind Texas Pacific Land, TPL, which owns about 870,000 acres. LandBridge's largest tenant is fellow Best Buy's entry WaterBridge Infrastructure, WBI, detailed above. LandBridge earns royalties for every barrel of water injected into its land. It also collects royalties for allowing water to pass through its land via pipelines. These surface use royalties, as they are called, make up 68% of LandBridge's revenue, the largest portion of the business. The next largest component is resource sales and royalties at 24% of revenue. This revenue comes from the sales of produced water to shale drillers for use in fracking operations. Finally, the company also earns royalties from allowing the extraction of oil and gas on its properties, which makes up 6% of revenue. The thing we like about the business is that it primarily operates as a passive landholder, collecting royalty fees for the use of its land. This means minimal operating expenses and juicy profit margins. Last year, LandBridge took in $199 million in revenue and generated $177 million in EBITDA, for a remarkable 89% operating margin. And like most royalty companies, the business requires very few capital expenditures, allowing it to convert 61% of every dollar of revenue into free cash flow. LandBridge reported Q4 results on February 25 that blew away all expectations. Revenue increased 56% year-over-year, YI, to $56.8 million, while EBITDA jumped 61% to $51.1 million, both exceeding analyst estimates. The Q4 results capped off an incredible growth rate of 200% in the last 2 years alone, even as oil prices have traded lower over that time period, going for $60 per barrel in Q4 before the war in Iran boosted the price to around $100 per barrel. This highlights the strength of its business model, with a dominant acreage position in the heart of the Permian Basin. Even when oil prices are low, it grows at incredible rates, because it's one of the few companies with available pore space to handle wastewater disposal in the Permian. Why LandBridge is a best buy with water demand in the Permian continuing to rise and a dominant land position that its competitors can't replicate, we see a lucrative road ahead for LandBridge. Given its rapid growth trajectory and a high-margin, asset-light business model, we view LandBridge as one of the highest-quality compounders in the market today. Shares of LandBridge's closest peer, Texas Pacific Land, trade at a 43x forward free cash flow multiple, despite generating the same operating margins and with a slower growth rate. And yet LandBridge trades at a nearly 30% discount, a discount we believe could eventually close. Action to take: buy LandBridge, NYSE, pound, up to $104.31 per share every month. We highlight three current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point, and we include those with the best buying opportunity as our best buys. While we sometimes alternate which companies we list as our best buys, removing a stock from the list does not necessarily mean we no longer recommend it, nor does it imply a recommendation to sell shares in that company once it is no longer part of best buys. It's only that the new picks present an even more compelling investment opportunity. Last month's best buys: Omrise, AMRZ, Viper Energy, VNOM, and Kinsale Capital, KNSL, remain strong buys. Porter & Company, Stevenson, Maryland.